right. Well, let's open up our Bibles to the 11th chapter of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel, chapter 11. Now, when we think of David, we associate David with two names, right? David and what? David and Goliath, and David and Bathsheba. And of course, one of those names reminds us of the great victory that took place in the man's life. And the other one reminds us of the tragic loss and failure that took place in the man's life. And as we come now to chapter 11, we come to the great blunder of David. And there isn't a great deal that makes sense about this story. But as we get into the anatomy of lust, we're going to see that one of the things that lust does is that lust is able to take what is otherwise an intelligent human being and turns them into an absolute fool. I am sure that in the years after chapter 11, that no doubt David, as he would reflect upon this chapter of his life, would think to himself, what in the world was I doing? What in the world was I thinking? Well, hopefully, as we begin to look at how lust made its way through David's life, we will learn from it and we will not repeat the same mistakes that was made in the life of David. So, beginning in verse 1, we read this. It came to pass that after the year was expired, at the time when the kings would go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and they besieged Rabbah, but David tarried at Jerusalem. Now remember, the last time we were together, there was some unfinished business. You remember how that David had sent Joab out after Ammon because Ammon had humiliated a couple of government officials that David had sent to them to really give sympathy to this poor guy who had lost his father. And so in response, David said to Joab, "You go get him." Well, Ammon realized what they had done. They created an alliance between themselves and Syria, and Syria came in behind the forces of Joab. Joab found himself surrounded, but God was merciful and God gave them the victory, chased the Syrians off, and Ammon went back into their fortified city. Well, then Joab left. He didn't finish going after the Syrians. The Syrians reorganized themselves. They became another threat to Israel. And so this time David went out after them. And David so thoroughly thrashed the Syrians that they came to the peace table and they said, "Hey, we will no longer align ourselves with any of your enemies. We want to have peace with you. We will be your servants." And there is the indication there that they began to pay tribute unto David. So here's the picture. David sent Joab out. Joab was not finishing the job. Joab, a brilliant warrior, but not much of a military strategist, and he didn't finish the job. David goes out, the job gets completed. Now, you will never fall, but what you won't be able to look back and see that somewhere along the line, God had been warning you. You will never be rubbing your forehead and thinking, "What have I done and why have I done it and how have I become so stupid?" With what you won't be able to look back in your life and see, right there, God was warning me. Right there, God was speaking to me. Right there, God was showing me what I should have been doing. And God, I believe, had been showing David, your place is with the military. Your place is leading the men. That is not Joab's job. That is your job. And so here is David. He is not where he is supposed to be. He's hanging out in the palace while the army is out there fighting. Now, I don't believe that what we read next should be a surprise. I don't think that it happened all of a sudden. I believe that what transpired in this man's life had been building for some 20 years, and that this guy has been set up. The enemy is a master psychologist. He will watch an individual for decades, and once they're big, dumb, and happy, then he springs the trap. And I believe that's exactly what happens now in our hero's life. Well, in verse 2, we read this. And it came to pass that in eventide, this would be late afternoon, that David arose from off of his bed, and he walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. So it's late afternoon. David has had an extremely long nap. He's a musician. Of course, they don't get up before 3 anyway. And so here he is. He wakes up. And he's walking on his roof. Now, the word walk there means to pace. He's uneasy. And you're always uneasy when you know you're somewhere where you're not supposed to be. So here's the scene. He's pacing. He's uneasy. He's had this long nap. He's got bedhead and fresh blanket creases on his face. And he's looking off from his roof. And all of a sudden, there's the supermodel. And she's taken a bath. And so here we find the great king is now evolved into a window peeper, if you will. And he's checking out the chick. And now we might ask ourselves, how many women does this man need? I mean, how many women does a man need? This guy has got a house full of women, for crying out loud. And does he really need one more? But again, as we look at lust, the nature of lust is such, not only does it turn you into an idiot, but it also refuses to be satisfied. What David and Solomon teach a man is, if one woman is not enough, 1,000 will not be enough. If one sports car is not enough, 1,000 sports cars are not enough. If the first million is not enough, the second million will not be enough either. This is the nature of lust. This man has a house full of women, but he is not satisfied with the house full of women that he has. He wants one more. He wants that which is not his. He wants that which doesn't belong to him. And so then in verse 3, and David sent and he inquired after the woman, and one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now he is given a very clear message. This woman is not for you. This woman is spoken for. Now, of course, he's being told she's not available, and he's also being told that, first of all, she is the daughter of one of your mighty men. Eliam was one of the mighty men of David. David would have known with this bit of information that she was also the granddaughter of Ahithophel, which was his senior national security advisor, and then she was also the wife of Uriah, who was also on the list of David's mighty men. So David has been given a bit of information which is telling him, if you cross the line, you are going to be hurting those who are important to you and those who are close to you. Now, again, looking at the anatomy of lust, look at the 4 things that he's told. She is not on the market. She is not available to you. She is the daughter of this guy. She is the granddaughter of this important figure. And she is the wife of this important figure. Now, he has just been given 4 very negative pieces of information. But the way that lust operates in us is that lust, rather than looking at the negative, lust seems to focus on the positive, so to speak. Hey, you say her dad's a mighty man and you say her husband's a mighty man. Well, that means her dad and her husband is out of town. I might just be able to get away with this. That's what lust was whispering into this man's ear. Now, again, the Bible tells us to flee youthful lust. The Bible tells us to get away. Now, the reason that we must flee is because it is in us. I have lust in me. I have desire in me. I cannot surgically go in and remove that from my heart. So therefore, because I can't get it out of me, I have to get me out of the situation where it can be a problem. Now, you remember that James tells us that, look, where sin comes from is that you have temptation. You have the opportunity to sin, and then you have lust. And when the lust that is in you is linked with the temptation that is now being made available to you, then it conceives and it brings forth sin. And that's exactly what's going to happen with David. So then in verse 4 we read, "And David sent messengers and took her. And she came in unto him, and he laid with her, and she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her house." So they have now brought the intern now to the White House. And of course, now David, now remember, David is at least 50 years old. We're not talking about a 20-year-old kid with testosterone levels, you know, off the charts here. We're talking about an older man, and we're talking about an older man that is now seducing a young woman who is the age of his daughters. We would classify David as being a dirty old man, and he is messing around with this girl that he shouldn't be. Now, when it says that her uncleanness is now past, it means that she has recently had her period, so therefore she is not pregnant. She was not pregnant because she just had her period when she came through those palace doors. But she is going to be pregnant when she leaves. So the writer here is making it very clear she's going to be with child, and that child is definitely David. Now, what we have to understand is that lust is like a pop machine. It's like a Coke machine. That when you're standing in front of that pop machine and it's 50 cents and you put a quarter in, when you have put that first quarter in, you are still in control. You can push the change return button and the transaction is over with. It is not going anywhere. When David was up on his roof, he put the first quarter in. And instead of pushing the change return button and backing away from the roof and going and taking a cold bath himself or taking advantage of one of his, you know, many wives, he doesn't do that, but he leaves the quarter in. And then you put the second quarter in. You're still not obligated. It's not a done deal. You can still back away and push the button. When he was told she is spoken for, she is not available, this is a chick you don't want to be messing with, David, instead of backing away, he goes ahead and he leaves the second quarter in. Now she's there in his bedchamber, and he has pushed the Coke button. Now, when you have pushed that Coke button, the transaction is made, and there is nothing you can do that's going to keep that Coke from coming out of that machine. When we start messing around with lust, and we start getting phone numbers, and we start flirting around, we're putting quarters into that machine. And if we don't wake up to the reality of what we are doing, one more step, we're going to push that button, and it is too late, and the transaction is going to be made. And that's exactly what David does right here. And he should have known better. He is a 50-year-old man messing around with a girl that, you know, is less than half his age. Well, then we read in verse 5 that the woman conceived, and she sent, and she told David, and she said, "I am with child." Now, this is not what David was planning on, and rarely do men plan on receiving this kind of an email or this kind of a message. Golly, I just wanted to have some fun, right? It was just the heat of the moment. Well, his fun has gotten him an unwanted pregnancy. It's going to end up getting bringing forth the murder of a trusted friend, and it's going to produce eventually a dead baby within his house. And this is all because he did not count the cost. When lust is at its work in our life, we oftentimes are allowing it to go forward because we're not counting the cost. Now, the time to count the cost is not in the midst of the temptation. The time to count the cost is not when you find yourself in a hotel room with somebody that you shouldn't be with. It's too late, man. You have pushed the Coke button, your goose is cooked, and it is game over when it has gotten to that point. The time to count the cost is tonight before you fall asleep. The time to count the cost is when you wake up in the morning. If I allow lust to capture me, What is it going to cost me? What is it going to ruin in my life? That's when we count the cost. Don't count the cost when you're being tempted. You don't have the capacity to do it. Then everything looks great and you think you're going to get away with it. But before you get to that point, daily ask yourself, if I stumble, what is it going to ruin in my life? If I depart from the Lord's will for my life, what is it going to cost me? Well, then in verse 6, David sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah unto David. And Uriah was come unto him, and David demanded of him how Joab did and how the people did and how the war prospered. And David said unto Uriah, now go down unto the house and wash your feet. And Uriah departed the king's house, and there followed him food from the king. And Uriah, though, slept at the door of the king's house with all of the servants of the Lord, of his Lord, and went not down to his house. And when they had told David, saying, Uriah went not down to his house, David said unto Uriah, camest thou not from your journey? Why then did you not go down into your house? And notice this man. Uriah said unto David, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in an open field. Shall I then go into my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Now, this is an incredible man, is it not? He is home on leave. He has faced the enemy. He has been fighting battles, and now he has an opportunity to finally sleep in a bed with his wife and enjoy all of the comforts of a married man. But yet he is sympathetic to the cause of his brothers that are still out there sleeping under the sun. This man, Uriah, is a better man than David. He is a more honorable man than David. This lets us know that sometimes better men are killed. It lets us know that sometimes better men are taken advantage of. Now, when a man or a woman is unwilling to repent, when a man or woman is unwilling to come clean about the situation, the weasel takes over. And now we're seeing that the king has evolved from a window peeper to now he has evolved into a weasel. And now he's going to begin to weasel in verse 12. And David said unto Uriah, you wait here a day also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. And so Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And David called him, and he did eat and drink before him, and he made him get drunk. And it was evening, and he went to lie on his bed with the servants of his Lord, but he went not down into his own house. Now, the problem that David is facing here is that the clock is ticking, right? There is a baby in the oven, and we got to get this deal wrapped up in a hurry, because I am sure that not only was Uriah a mighty man for David, he probably knew basic math, and he was going to be able to figure out just when this wife of his conceived this baby. And so David now is being pressured, and so the weasel is becoming now this trapped rat. Now, here is the interesting thing about our fallen nature. Isn't it fascinating when our heart is set about to do something good that the least little roadblock will get us off of our path? Isn't it interesting? We'll have some grand idea. Oh, I know of a good thing that I can do. And we'll set off to do that good thing. And the littlest, the least roadblock that's put in our path will immediately conclude, not God's will, not the timing, didn't hear right from God. Now, when our heart is set to do evil, isn't it amazing the roadblocks that we will bulldoze over if we have to in order to satisfy the lust of our flesh or this evil desire? Our hearts gravitate towards iniquity. Here is David. Well, by golly, that didn't work. I'll try this. I'll get him drunk. This is a man who loves God. David loves loves God. David is a man that knows God. David is a man that's saved. David is a man that's anointed with God's Spirit. But David is a man who has been trapped by his own lust, and he feels that there is no way out but continue to dig a little bit deeper. And so then in verse 14, it came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter saying, set ye Uriah in the foremost of the hottest battle and retire from him that he may be smitten and die. And it came to pass that when Joab observed the city, that he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew that the valiant men were. And the men of that city went out, and they fought with Joab. And there fell some of the people of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Now, Uriah is unwittingly the messenger of his own death sentence. Now, understand the integrity of this man, and understand how that David knew this was a man of integrity. He hands this guy the letter. You take this letter, which is, by the way, your death sentence, and you take it to Joab. Now, how long a walk it was to the front, I really don't know. But don't you think, I mean, if it was me, I would have snooped a little, right? I mean, this is a message from the king to the general. What does this have to say? But David was so sure of Uriah's integrity that he knew, I can write a letter that will tell Joab to kill this guy. And this guy has such integrity, he will not read it between here and the front. Now, Joab, of course, Joab is a good Nazi, right? I mean, an innocent guy is getting killed, but hey, you know, I'm following orders. But of course, Joab, he doesn't care about human life. He doesn't care about anything. Joab was a man that was only interested in position and power. And if he has received orders from on high to kill an innocent man, well, that's just the way it goes. Well, then we read in verse 18 that Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war. And he charged the messenger, saying that when you have made an end of telling the matters of the war unto the king, if it be that the king's wrath arise, and he's saying to you, why did you approach so near unto the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who smote Abimelech, the son of Jebusheth, and not a woman, and did not a woman cast a piece of a millstone upon him from the wall, and he died at Thebez? Why went you so near unto the wall? And you shall say that your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. And so the messenger went and came and showed David all that Joab sent him for. And the messenger said unto David, surely the men prevailed against us, and they came out of the unto the field, and we were upon them, even upon the entering of the gate, and the shooters shot from off of the wall upon your servants, and some of the king's servants are dead, and thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. And then David said unto the messenger, thus shall you say unto Joab, let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city and overthrow it. And he encouraged him. Now, essentially, David is saying, well, you know, no harm done. Now, there are these men that are killed. They are killed unnecessarily. Joab has the suspicion that maybe this will torque off the king. And so he tells the messenger that, hey, if you see him getting red in the face, you know, just sort of cut his anger off at the pass and tell him that Uriah is dead as well. And now at this point, I'm sure that inwardly, David is rejoicing. He is probably thinking, my plan has worked. But has his plan really worked? Notice verse 26. And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. Now, there is no indication that she was a part of the plan to kill her husband. As far as we can tell, she had no clue that this was coming. At this point, she probably was not aware that David was the one that killed her husband. Now, she's going to find this out after she's married to the guy. I hope that they've got this on video in heaven. You know, the facial expression of Bathsheba when she learns that this turkey that she's married was the very... I mean, imagine being a woman and you messed around with this guy and, you know, now your husband's dead. And so the guy you messed around with, you're now married to. And then he told, oh, by the way, I killed your husband, right? I'm sure that took her back a step or two. But again, this was a bittersweet message for her. Remember the culture. The culture is adulterers are to be stoned to death. Her neck is on the line. And so on the one hand, yes, my husband has been killed on the war front. But on the other hand, gee, I'm not going to die. So, you know, that's got to temper the sorrow a little bit, right? But then verse 27. And when the morning was past, that is the crying, the sobbing, was past, that David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. If it wasn't for that sentence, right? You know, if it wasn't for that last sentence, David would have come out of this deal just smelling like a rose, right? Because he appears to be the hero to the community, right? You've got this young, poor gal that's now a widow. And oh, golly, her husband was just home on leave and impregnated her. And now you're going to have this poor child born to a fatherless home. And I hear there wasn't much life insurance, you know. And then all of a sudden, here comes the king. Boy, just coming in, you know, like a knight in shining armor. And oh, I'll save the day. I'll take this poor young, you know, pregnant widow and I'll bring her into my house and I'll, by golly, I'll raise that child as my own. I'm sure that there were people that were floored by the generosity of David. Such hypocrisy was going on. But God saw it. God, now David was only interested in pleasing himself, but notice what happened is that David ended up displeasing God. And more times than not, that's what happens in our life. We set out on a journey to please ourselves, and we end up displeasing the Lord. Now, I believe that what this chapter teaches us is that nobody is immune here. Nobody is immune from falling. Here is a man after God's heart. Here is the great worship leader of the assembly of God's people. Here is a guy that knows God like nobody's business. And yet, what has this man done? Think of the depth of this man's sin. Had it been anybody else, I mean, if somebody comes along to you during the week and says, oh, I read this story in the paper, this guy did this, and this guy did that, and oh, what a creep he was. But because it's David, you know, we tend to, well, it wasn't really, you know, really that bad, was it? I think because it's David, we don't quite understand the severity and the grossness and the hypocrisy that's going on here. And I believe that what we are to take away from this story is that we must keep ourselves in that place of safety. Nobody is safe. We have to understand that. This is a man that's been walking with the Lord for years. This is a man that has seen the delivering power of God time and time again. This was a guy that understood the heartbeat of God. And this is a guy that's impregnated another man's wife, has killed the man, and is now lying to the community about the situation. This is what the man of God has sunken to. And all of us have that capacity within us if we ourselves will not watch and pray and continue to remind ourselves the cost of rebellion and the cost of pleasing ourselves. So we should be praying, Lord, make us aware of how vulnerable we all are. Make us aware that there is not much between us and failure except for the grace of God and the power of God. And therefore, we need to be availing ourselves to His grace and His power.